Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I want to welcome back one of our regular guest co-hosts, Dr. Michael Bach-Atlas. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
Recently, we had a fascinating guest, Dr. Donald Hoffman, professor of cognitive science at the University of California, Irvine, about the gap between what we see, hear, feel, smell, taste, and reality. What do you think?
My mind is already blown.
I think it's going to blow a lot of our minds because it really suggests the senses may be perceptions and not reality itself. You're going to have to stay tuned. It is mind-blowing. First of all, we have some really practical research that matters. Our very smallest one is really kind of near and dear to me. It's about hand washing. Why is this near and dear to both of us?
Well, Adam, have you ever seen that person that leaves the bathroom and you know that they didn't wash their hands?
No. And we will never admit that, right? We
never admit to that. So this is really important, though. So as it relates to some viruses out there that can be pretty dangerous. So have you ever heard of norovirus before?
Yeah, norovirus is really critical. Everyone knows it's the kind of the cruise ship one that causes cruise ships to have to turn around. But also in a school system up in Connecticut recently, 100 kids showed up at school really sick with norovirus in the same day.
This is responsible, norovirus, for about 20% of cases worldwide of acute gastroenteritis. And the symptoms are pretty terrible. They include nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. And it only takes one particle, I said that, one particle to infect a human compared to 50 to 100 particles for the flu virus.
Wow. So it's incredibly contagious. And I remember once, Michael, when I was a volunteer physician with a group of 1,000 athletes down in South America in Argentina, and we had three doctors for that 1,000-person contingent, and norovirus went through. And the first day, we saw 10 cases. The second day, 40 cases. The third day, 200 cases. And we're pretty overwhelmed because if the next day we'd gone to 400 cases, we would have had hospitalizations left and right. It's a scary disease. What is this research about then?
So this research is out of the Royal Society of Open Science, and this looks at hand washing and really, you know, how does that compare to other methods for reducing spread of disease? And they found that as it relates to cruise ships, that if about 80% of passengers were able to change their habits, particularly if they wash their hands for 20 seconds or more, that they would have been able to halt the outbreak that they studied in this particular study.
And they go into details about the correct method of doing it and lots of other things. It's kind of like, reminds me like, you know, when you put on sunscreen, there's a kind of a correct method. But I think more importantly is, do you do this enough? Do you wash your hands? I know Michael and I, we get judged, rated quality. When we go into a patient's room, are we washing our hands before we touch the patient, and do we wash our hands after we touch the patient? And we have quality improvement activities to help us and our staff do that so that we aren't giving contagions to other staff. We need to kind of teach this in perhaps in schools and when you go on cruises.
The biggest question I have, Adam, is in Argentina, did you get sick?
I did not get sick, but I can tell you one of our doctors did, and that then took us down to two doctors. That wasn't fun.
No.
Well, let's talk about our next research that matters, which is using e-cigarettes, electronic cigarettes, otherwise known as ENDS or electronic nicotine delivery systems. And our kids and a lot of young people know them as Juuls because that's the most popular brand, and they say they're Juuling, which is really vaping.
So this study came out of the UNC School of Medicine, and researchers show that these e-liquids are really far from harmless and contain ingredients that vary very widely from one type of e-cigarette to the next.
Yeah, and there was a National Academy of Sciences report that came out in January of 2018 that really said, well, what is known is that there are some toxicities. We don't know the severity. And this research out of Dr. Robert Terrain's laboratory at UNC and in the journal PLOS Biology Plus Biology really begins to say they can assess more rapidly the damage to tissue, whether it's lung tissue or other tissue in the body, when exposed to certain constituents in e-cigarettes. What two were kind of common that when exposed to a vapor in this e-cigarette liquid were actually potentially toxic to tissue?
So the greatest toxicity, Adam, came from two flavored compounds. That's vanillin and cinnamaldehyde. And these you don't use with your French toast, okay? You really
right.
don't. These we want to stay away from. But these have been widely used in e-liquids. And as you said, there are more than 7,700 e-liquid products out there. So the ability to test these more rapidly is really important. And they actually the group that did this study and their colleagues set up a database for e-liquid ingredients and toxicity that you can find at www.eliquidinfo.org.
Yeah, it's different when you're eating something like has vanilla or cinnamon. If anyone's actually accidentally inhaled cinnamon into their lungs, they'll know how toxic and how much coughing and difficulty that has. So good work out of our colleagues at University of North Carolina. Let's talk about the last research that matters, which is whether one walks a little faster. Would you say you're a slow walker, a medium walker, or a fast walker?
I'd say if you could compare my walking speed to like a tortoise, that would probably be about accurate.
And are you going to change based on this research?
I might. I might try and speed it up a notch.
Well, let's talk then. What does this research show about the pace at which one walks and what impact that has on health?
So this came out of, Adam, the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology. It was a three-year study, looked at over 1,000 patients with hypertension, and many also had a coronary artery disease or valvular disease. And they looked at three different types of speeds that were defined as slow, about a mile and a half or 1.5 miles per hour, intermediate, about 2.5 miles per hour, and fast, 3 miles an hour, were the three different speeds that they looked at.
And there was actually significant differences in risk of hospitalization. If you were a fast walker, you only had a risk of 31% of being hospitalized. But if you were a slow walker, you had 51%. And not only that, the length of the hospital day was, you know, 2 to 3 times higher if you were a slow walker compared to a fast walker. So fast walking was a barometer, a marker for overall improved health, which makes some sense because if you're in good enough health to walk fast, maybe you would be in better health and not be hospitalized. On the other hand, it suggests that perhaps we should encourage people not only to walk, but to increase the pace if they can.
Makes me want to go out and get a new pair of walking shoes right now.
Good research. Well, that'll conclude actually the research that matters portion of our show. And we're going to take a short break. And when we return, we're going to hear an interview with Dr. Donald Hoffman, professor of cognitive science at the University of California, Irvine, about the gap between what we see, hear, feel, smell, and taste and reality. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Donald Hoffman, professor of cognitive science at the University of California, Irvine, about the gap between what we see, hear, feel, smell, and taste and reality. Welcome, Dr. Hoffman.
Thank you very much, Adam. Good to be here.
You know, it's really great to have you here. And I must say, it's a little intimidating because the research that you do really bends our understandings of what reality is. And that's intimidating even for a radio host scientist. So I must say I'm going at it with trepidation, but it's really important.
It is a fun topic, but it does challenge some deeply held beliefs.
Well, first off, before we get into some of those beliefs, help us understand a little bit about you. How did you get really interested broadly in research and this research specifically?
I've been interested since I was a teenager in questions like, are we just machines? What makes humans special, if anything? And so I was very interested to get the tools that I would need to understand and study that question. And I found, when I was an undergraduate at UCLA, I found a class on artificial intelligence and some work in vision science in artificial intelligence, and I decided that would be a great way for me to really learn the field and to learn what machines can do. So I went to MIT and was in the artificial intelligence laboratory at MIT, working with David Marr in vision science and also in the what's now the brain and cognitive sciences department. So I've been at it since the late 70s, studying artificial intelligence, human vision, human psychology, and robotic vision, just trying to get the tools I would need to really understand what are machines, what can they do, and what are we, and are we different or not from machines?
Well, is it all our perceptions that we're different?
Yeah, what I found when I was studying visual perception was that it doesn't behave the way most of us think. We typically think, for example, that vision is just like a camera that takes a picture of a real world with shapes and colors and objects and space and time that would exist even if there were no creatures that existed to perceive it. So we believe it's all there and that we're just taking a picture of it. And the story that comes out of cognitive neuroscience is different. It says we're not just taking a picture, we're constructing what we see in real time. In about 100 milliseconds, a tenth of a second, you're using billions of neurons and trillions of synapses to create the colors and motions and objects and shapes that you see. But most of my colleagues in the neurosciences believe that what we construct, you know, the shapes and colors and objects that we construct are usually pretty faithful to what really exists in reality. So we construct what we see, but we usually reconstruct what's there in reality. And I began to study that question a little bit more carefully. I asked, is it really the case that our perceptions are giving us true information about objective reality? And one of the scientific disciplines that I thought would be the best to address that question is evolution by natural selection. The idea is that our senses evolved and were shaped by natural selection pressures. So we can ask, does that fact give us any insight into whether our perceptions show us reality as it is? And many of my colleagues think, yes, it does. And they think that the answer is that evolution by natural selection would favor true perceptions. And the argument is actually quite plausible. The argument is that those of our ancestors who saw reality more truly would have a competitive advantage in important activities like feeding, fighting, fleeing, and mating. And as a result, they would be more likely to win the competition and pass on their genes, which coded for the more accurate perceptions. And so over thousands of generations of this, we're the offspring of those who saw more accurately in each generation. And so we can be quite confident that we see more accurately reality as it is. So that's a very plausible argument, and most of my colleagues buy some version of that argument, even in the textbooks that we use.
But you may see it differently, you or at least you can at least propose something that's really opposed to that or different than that.
Very different from that. So what I decided to do was, it turns out evolution by natural selection is now a mathematically precise theory. We have the mathematics called evolutionary game theory. And so we can actually state this hypothesis as a precise mathematical question, and we can actually do two things. We can run simulations in which we pit organisms that see reality as it is against organisms that don't and are just tuned to so-called fitness functions.
What type of organisms?
We can simulate anything that we want. So we can create hundreds of thousands of random worlds with random resources in it, and then we just created abstract computational organisms, so to speak, that we played God. We could let the organisms see all of the truth in the worlds that we created, or some of the truth, or none of the truth, and just have them be tuned to the fitness payoffs that were important.
And this would be through artificial intelligence?
This would be like an all artificial worlds, artificial organisms with,
yep.
So that we could completely control the perceptions that they had.
Okay.
And see, as a mathematical exercise, what natural selection would really do. And what we found in the simulations was that organisms that saw the truth always went extinct when they competed against organisms that saw none of the truth and were just tuned to the fitness functions, especially, you know, when the organisms were of equal complexity. And even organisms that were of less complexity could often win if they didn't see the truth and were just tuned to fitness. So then I worked with a mathematician And we proved a theorem. So it's actually a theorem that if our senses evolved and were shaped by natural selection, the probability is essentially zero that any of our perceptions show us reality as it is. It's quite stunning.
So how does this this is a fundamental shift, clearly, in terms of kind of the consciousness of biology. But how does that then play out in things that we might think of every day, as it maybe affects people's health, maybe as it affects how one lives one's life, how it affects how one plans for strategies of being healthier? Does this lead us to different places?
Well, it does in the sense that it turns out that our perceptual systems aren't there to show us the truth. They're really just like a user interface, like the desktop on your computer or on your mobile phone or something like that. And the icons on the desktop aren't there to show you the truth. They're there to hide all the diodes and resistors inside the computer, and they just give you guides to behave in ways to stay alive. And so on the health issue, it really is that everything that we see, all the objects and colors and motions and shapes that we see, are there not as indicators of the truth of objective reality. They're there to guide our behavior so that we can stay alive long enough to reproduce. So in some sense, what this point of view says is that all of our perceptions are there not to show us the truth, but to keep us alive. So it is sort of a health-centered focus that evolution has, but only partially in the sense that evolution keeps us alive long enough to raise kids, and then it doesn't care anymore.
Wow. Some might look at that and feel then, does that mean that one's perceptions don't matter? I don't think that's what you're saying, though.
Absolutely not. In fact, quite to the contrary. Our perceptions have shaped for the purpose of only mattering, to keep us alive. So everything that we see is not there to show us the truth. It's there to be taken seriously so we know how to act to stay alive. So it's really, if you see a snake, don't pick it up. If you see a cliff, don't step off. We're not seeing reality as it is. We're just seeing essentially icons in our user interface. But the icons are shaped by natural selection for the purpose of keeping us alive and guiding behaviors. And so for example, just to get this idea about perception and reality concretely, if you're writing an email and the icon on your desktop for that email is not there to show you the truth, the transistors and voltages and magnetic fields, it's there to hide all that very complicated truth. If you had to toggle voltages to send an email, your friends would never hear from you. The truth gets in the way. So that's what evolution has done. It really is about taking it seriously and keeping us alive. It's giving us just the eye candy we need to stay alive and, reproduce and raise kids. But truth gets in the way, just like seeing the voltages in your computer and toggling them would get in the way of doing your email. That's just not what you want. So the desktop interface lets you control reality while you're completely ignorant about the nature of reality. And being ignorant is actually a virtue, because if you had to know all the complexity, it would be so complex that you wouldn't be able to control it. So our perceptual systems evolved to let us do what we need to do and throw away all the truth that we don't need to know, which is all the truth. We don't need to know any truth. All we need to know are the fitness payoffs and how to get them.
Well, we're going to take a short break. But when we come back, we're going to actually talk about how we define fitness in the quantitative, psychological, social consciousness, evolutionary psychology way. And then we'll talk about what this means for not only for individuals, but for groups of people living together. We're going to take a short break. But when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Donald Hoffman, professor of cognitive science at the University of California, Irvine, about the gap between what we see, hear, feel, smell, and taste in reality. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with Dr. Donald Hoffman, professor of cognitive science at the University of California, Irvine, about his really fascinating research about visionary science and evolutionary psychology and how the gap between what we see, hear, feel, smell, and taste is with perhaps reality. You mentioned the word fitness. What do you mean by fitness as it relates to the work that you do in your research?
So imagine a T-bone steak, and you can ask, what fitness benefits does that T-bone steak offer to different organisms? So for example, consider a hungry lion that's looking to eat. Well, that T-bone steak will offer a lot of fitness points for that lion. But now imagine the same lion who's full and looking to mate. Well, now that T-bone steak offers it really no fitness points. And if you think about a cow, for any state and for any action, the T-bone steak is not going to do it much good. And so the point about fitness is fitness depends on objective reality, whatever objective reality might be. In this example, the quote-unquote reality was the T-bone steak and the organisms. So it depends on objective reality, but also on the organism, like the lion versus the cow, its state, hungry versus full, and the action, eating, feeding, fleeing, mating, and so forth. So fitness functions are these highly nonlinear, highly variable functions that depend on objective reality, the organism, its state, and the action. And one other example, for example, being 5,000 feet underwater is great for a benthic fish. It would kill Hoffman. So the same state of the world can be great fitness to one organism and terrible for another. So fitness functions vary all over the place. And these fitness functions are the key elements in evolution by natural selection. They govern who wins and who loses.
When we think about winning and losing, we oftentimes think of this as on an individual level. And I wonder, how do populations that interact with each other, how does this winning and losing and this fitness play out as we think of, in my field, population health, for instance?
Well, the best theories we have right now about evolution suggest that placing an emphasis on a gene-centered point of view is the right way to think about it, so that it's that evolution is really about genes getting a ticket into the next generation. And so sometimes genes will use tricks that involve social elements. So altruism, for example, some genes will code for us to have altruistic behavior, which allows, perhaps sometimes I'll sacrifice myself to let somebody else survive. And if that other person also has a copy of the gene, then even though my copy of the gene might disappear, the others, but the gene will still get into the next generation. And so there are tricks that genes use that lead to altruism and social interactions, and then other tricks that are just more individual-centered. So it captures both the individual and a lot of social interactions. And in fact, the field of evolutionary psychology is a very rich field that for the first time gives us principled understanding of the logic of human emotions and why we evolved emotions of jealousy and altruism and competition and in-groups and out-groups and so forth. It's a beautiful and quite sophisticated theory now.
So can you model this interaction between genes and decision-making, genes and psychology, almost like autonomous genes?
Yes, you can. And in fact, evolutionary game theory sort of is a way of getting at how genes evolve and how they code for different properties in your body, how that will make the body and therefore the genes more likely to survive and reproduce. So we have tools of evolutionary game theory, evolutionary graph theory, and genetic algorithms. So it's become a quite sophisticated enterprise. Evolution is no longer just a hand wave. It's a very sophisticated bit of mathematics. It's not just some stories about what happened in the past. We can use it to make predictions about the future.
So how do you think then, with this progress in the technology, it will help us understand human behavior in ways that may improve health?
Well, it's going to help us by getting rid of a false idea, right? If we have a false understanding about what is it that we're seeing, what are our perceptions showing us, that's going to be a big, big help in just coming to a truer understanding of who we are and what's affecting our health. And I can give a concrete example of the kind of thing that I'm talking about here in terms of our perceptions and reality. There was a fellow named Michael who was a synesthete. Synesthesia is a sort of a mixing of the senses that about 4% of the population has, where they experience multiple senses where we only experience one. And in Michael's case, for everything that he tasted, on his tongue. He also felt it with his hands in three-dimensional space in front of him. So when he tasted mint, he felt an object in front of him that was like a tall, cold, smooth column of glass. It was systematic. Every time he tasted mint, he felt this tall, cold column of glass. When he tasted Angostura bitters, which is the kind of bitter that you put in drinks, he felt something that was like a specific object, a basket of ivy. And he could feel all the individual leaves of the ivy and the texture of the surface of the ivy and so forth. And what's interesting is that he was experiencing these specific objects in three dimension for different chemical structures that he was tasting. And these objects that he was experiencing, of course, chemicals don't look like ivy and they don't look like tall, cold columns of glass. His sensory system had given him a nice interface of objects to represent things that we think of as chemicals that are not anywhere like objects. And this helps us to get rid of the idea that the objects that we see, you know, the cars and tables and forks and spoons and so forth, that those things are necessarily like something in objective reality. No, they're arbitrary symbols that we use that are part of our interface that just help us to do what we need to do. As it turned out, Michael was a great cook because he could fill all these three-dimensional objects in his hands for all the different things he was tasting. He was quite accomplished as a cook.
I'm tasting them right now. Let me ask a question. You know, you're talking about things that you perhaps could see or not see, but what about things that are emotions? So we talk about people who are depressed, people who are anxious. How does the paradigm change or not?
Well, it does. And in fact, that's where evolutionary psychology has a lot to offer us. And I can recommend a book by Steven Pinker called How the Mind Works, which is a great introduction. I think it was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, How the Mind Works. And any books by Steven Pinker where he really goes and shows how evolutionary psychology helps us to understand the logic of human emotions. I can give you just one fun example, but there are many. In fact, I think every human emotion can be treated and understood now or in the near future with ideas from evolutionary psychology. But just one idea, the feeling of attractiveness that we have when we look at a person. It turns out, from an evolutionary point of view, what's going on is that when you, in the first half second when you glance at a person, your visual system, in fact, all your senses are collecting dozens, perhaps hundreds of different sensory cues very rapidly, just a fraction of a second, and doing a really complicated computation to answer one question. The question is, what is the chance that this person in front of me could successfully raise kids? And if your answer says there's very high chance, then the emotion that you feel is attractiveness. If it's a very low chance, then it's not attractive. And so you get this essentially a sophisticated computation that's summarized in a simple slider from 0 to 10, hot to not, and that you're feeling, the emotional feeling is the summary description of a very sophisticated computation of high evolutionary significance. And lots of our emotions have that kind of very fascinating background to them. Our emotions are solutions to complex evolutionary problems.
We can determine within the first 10 to 30 seconds the information we may need rather than sometimes hours.
That's right. And in the case of attractiveness, I would say in about half a second. That's how quick we are and how fast the computation is. It's truly stunning. But in half a second, you have a very good estimate of the health and reproductive potential of the person in front of you. Of course, there's a lot more to human relationships than that. As you get to know a person, there's their sense of humor, things that you have in common. There's all sorts of other things that play a role in our ultimate decisions of who we're going to spend time with. But this initial half second is very important, and that's what's going on and the emotions that come out of that.
Let me ask you one final question. What are the ethics of the work that you do that sometimes maybe keep you up at night thinking, is this okay? Is this going to take in a different direction? Is it going to be used in a wrong way? What do you think about?
Well, I do think that evolutionary theory and evolutionary psychology really has challenged a lot of my assumptions about ethics. And I'm quite excited to see how an ethics will evolve that takes into account everything that we know about evolutionary biology. But one thing that some people think about evolutionary biology that I think is false and needs to be corrected is that evolution only is about nature red in tooth and claw, and it's only about us fighting each other and competing and trying to destroy each other. And that's not, I mean, there is that, of course. We do see some of nature red in tooth and claw, but there is another aspect that evolution and only evolution has given a nice understanding of, and that is of, for example, altruism. Why have we sometimes got inclinations to help other people, even at our own expense? And which people are we willing to help and how much? And it turns out the theory of evolution actually gives us an insight into who we're willing to help and even how much we're willing to help them. Once we understand this, once we understand human evolutionary psychology, we can actually devise social systems, political structures that try to bring out what Steven Pinker calls the better angels of our nature and that don't trigger some of the darker sides of our nature. So one thing I think evolutionary theory and understanding it, evolutionary psychology could help us to do is in an intelligent fashion create political systems and social structures that we're not going to change human nature, not overnight. I mean, human nature is what it is, but we can play human nature like we play the keys of the piano, and we can decide to play tunes that we love as opposed to tunes that are discordant. So can we set up social structures that will bring out the altruism, that will bring out cooperation, and play down the situations that tend to trigger anger, revenge, and these other aspects of human nature? So I do see a great potential forward for designing very ethical and human societies and structures, the social structures ahead.
Well, I can only say from your mouth to God's ears that an altruistic approach to the political systems in which we operate, what a pleasant and wonderful way to summarize really fascinating, really important work. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Adam. It was a pleasure.
We've been talking with Dr. Donald Hoffman, professor of cognitive science at the University of California, Irvine, about really some amazing body of lifelong research that's influencing the way we think and act about reality. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Michael and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And Michael, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. And this is a real question. It's not a perception of reality. It's not artificial intelligence. What do we got, Laura?
As everything continues to bloom, my allergies have been really bothersome. My daily Zyrtec and Flonase don't seem to be cutting it. Can I double up and take a second allergy medication until this subsides?
I think spring to summer allergies, oh my gosh, it's the grasses, the flowers, the pollens, it's brutal.
I mean, when your patio door is open and the pollen is actually on your hardwood floor, as it is in my house, you know you have a problem.
But, you know, this is a really important question about someone who has allergies. They're doing the typical things, which is taking probably an antihistamine and using some saline nasal spray, but it's not enough. What else could they do?
So there are a couple of things that you can do. So one is making sure that you're using the most of your, for example, nasal spray. And no financial disclosures here. Flonase works well. It's inexpensive. You can actually do two sprays in each nasal side each day is something that you can do. And also something I think works really well for a lot of patients, Adam, and is a little bit more time intensive, is nasal saline rinses multiple times a day to flush out the crud.
Yeah, because it will come back in if you're outside. I say also indoors, make sure you looked at your filters.
No. You're actually supposed to replace them pretty regularly.
Yeah. One other thing is that there are also other prescriptions. So one of the questions here is, could you take a second one? Not so certain that would help, but there may be other things that are similar, that other things, other types of mechanisms, antihistamines. So sometimes the over-the-counter antacids, Zantac has some histamine properties. So if you had a little bit of indigestion, that might work. You could also take other nasal sprays or prescription nasal sprays. And then finally, sometimes people take a short dose of oral steroids if it's really bad, just to shut it down, particularly if, like, you got to be singing at a performance, perhaps, as some of my patients sometimes do.
And that's right. I think that you also want to be careful, too, that, you know, if someone's having fevers or really pain in their face, that's really a separate process, and that could be a sign of a more serious bacterial infection. They should consult their healthcare provider.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I have a weird question. I've been having really heavy night sweats for the last week. I'm 61, and I haven't had my period for 6 years, so I don't think it's menopause. I really have been sopping wet, though. I don't have a fever, and I've never had this happen before. What do you think might be going on?
Well, we've had weirder questions than that.
We have, yes, certainly.
But it's unusual in terms of for this patient, right? This is not normal for this patient. And I wouldn't say it's in the top 100 things that comes into our clinic every day. So it's unusual enough, but it's not like unheard of.
And these are difficult when you get sometimes these messages, Adam, through, you know, our in-basket or our electronic messaging system. There's really nothing that really helps more to look at someone in the office in front of them, take a good history, do a good physical exam. And typically about 75 or 80% of the time we can get it right, I think.
Yeah. So more information would be helpful. One of the things we'd want to know is whether or not there's fever, because we have seen lots of kind of infections. People may not know they have infection. They might have a urinary tract infection. It could be in their bloodstream. So that would be one of the big things we'd want to make sure is not happening. What else?
One thing for me at, you know, the age of 61 is thyroid disease. So certainly, is the thyroid working too much, or is it not working enough? And that's an easy blood test to do as well.
People always are going to be worried about cancer. Let's just put the C word out there. Yep. And we know that people think, oh, I'm having sweats at night and lymphoma or other forms of cancer. And I have seen that. But this listener has only been having it for a week. So it's probably less likely common things happening commonly.
I agree. And I think the best thing that this person can do is just to be seen by their healthcare provider.
One other quick thought. Any medications that are new, because medications have side effects in just about everyone. So sometimes people will start a new antidepressant, and guess what? You go look at the side effects of that, and sweating is right there, lots of things. So I'd really want to know that.
Good thought, Adam.
What's our very last house call, Laura?
I'm a 62-year-old woman, and recently I've noticed that my left knee often randomly locks up. I can't think of anything that's happened recently that could be causing this. What do you think?
Should we just get it unlocked?
Get
a free get-out-of-jail card on Monopoly here? That's not going to work, is it?
Yeah, we need to find the key.
We need to find the key here.
Yeah, we do.
And probably the key here is that something is wrong in the knee itself.
That's what I typically think about when I hear locking, even just when a patient uses that word. I immediately think about the meniscus of the knee is kind of the first thing that comes to mind. And we have a few examinations that we can do to sort of elicit that and then really go from there.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, you know, you're moving around, then all of a sudden it hurts and it feels like it's locked. And then all of a sudden something happens and you can move it again. And sometimes that meniscus or the cartilage in the knee gets torn and it gets in an awkward position, and it can be really painful at those point in time. Then all of a sudden it kind of unlocks and you don't have it anymore. Well, in that case, there's actually some damage to perhaps the cartilage that's causing some rubbing. It doesn't be in all cases. I've seen a case or two, Michael, maybe you've seen this, where someone kind of walks a little bit awkwardly at times and their kneecap starts drifting, you know, right and left, and that gets into an awkward position. And you actually have to do some exercises to strengthen the inner thigh muscles, and that frequently can then get that knee to no longer kind of move out. So sometimes it could be something as simple as physical therapy.
And that's known as patellofemoral syndrome. And I think whenever we look at joints, we always have to think above the knee and below the knee. So like you said, mechanics are really important. So if someone's having a really ankle pain, but now it's causing their gait to be disturbed, they may be having knee pain. Or if there's something going on in the hip, it actually can go against the natural movements of the knee and exactly cause these problems.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, Michael. I hope we've unlocked some of the answers for our listeners, but we certainly, regardless, I don't know, they probably don't want to hear that anymore. But we do want to hear from our listeners about anything that is concerned to them, and they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. They can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, Dr. Michael Baca-Alice as co-host, and Dr. Donald Hoffman, our guest today. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas.
And look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.